Welcome to Off Grid with your award-winning podcast hosts, Boyd, that's me.
And Dave, that's me.
We've solved a cryptic crossword, so that you don't have to. Isn't that nice of us? And we've wrenched three clues from its grid to serve as topics for this episode.
Don't worry, you don't have to have solved the puzzle to follow along, but on the off chance that you want to, for this episode we've solved Filbert's puzzle from The Independent on Sunday of February the 11th, 2024. Which was puzzle number 1772. So if you care about spoilers, pause playback here and go tackle that first.
We'll also have a little general knowledge quiz at the end, also inspired by the puzzle. Pod to general knowledge receiving, over.
Copy that. General knowledge receiving loud and clear.
Fab. So, the first of those clues, which you can ignore if you like, because we'll be explaining them later, is going to come from Dave.
Thank you. I think we all agreed that 23 across was a standout. This one is light fitting in reach, stupidly broken by Trotter. And you're looking for a 10-letter word there. I'll give the answer and explanation for that after we've heard from the general. Have you got a word or a phrase from the crossword that set your mental cogs whirring?
Well, yes, I was inspired by 19 down, the answer to which was to death. Distinct from to the death, in that it can mean excessively, which was the definition here, but it also has meaning, you know, occurring until or causing death, like, you know, bled to death or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Death, yeah. Not the prettiest thing to talk about, so I'm going to have a quick little aside into the clue, which referred to fox and wolf. Now, I'm a cat person, first and foremost, and having to members of the family Canidae around wouldn't normally be my cup of tea, but foxes, it has been said, are just cat software running on dog hardware.
I like that quote.
But it is kind of true. They have the same sort of pouncing behaviour, especially when they're young and playing. Because they're going to be ambush predators, they get that practice in leaping onto their prey. And you have had people try and domesticate foxes as you would mm-hmm. domesticate wolves and such, and they say that they have roughly the same sort of problem solving abilities as a cat does. They do it in the same kind of way, independently of the humans, and very doggedly, in the sense of determined instead.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They also like to chase laser pointers.
Oh, do they?
They do. Dogs kind of, they will a bit, but they don't entirely get it.
Right.
I mean, I know a cat doesn't get it at all, but at least it will keep going for it. And a fox will do exactly the same thing.
Interested in it. Yeah.
Cats are.
Yeah, exactly. They gain an interest in. Oh, the dot. But yeah, I do like a fox. It is a good animal. I've done my aside about the fox, but it was actually the wolf being connected to death that was sort of the thing that tripped my mind a little bit.
Okay.
Have either of you two watched the Puss in Boots films that spun off of the Shrek franchise?
I know of them. This is Antonio Banderas, isn't it? I haven't seen them, no.
I think I might have seen 5 or 10 minutes of one.
Yeah. Yeah, Puss in Boots, all of the sort of characters in Shrek are sort of inspired by the ones you see in fairy tales.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But they are sort of riffs on them. They're not like straight tellings of these.
Yeah.
And Puss in Boots is basically Zorro. Like, I mean, literally Antonio Banderas is voicing Zorro. Not in the sense of, you know, where he played Zorro and the Mask of Zorro and the Legend of Zorro were on, but Puss in Boots is, he even slices a pea with his sword. Like, come on, it's Zorro. Right.
Okay.
Apparently, it was only after they got Antonio Banderas in for the role that they sort of changed it, because the original Puss in Boots, sort of the old fairy tales, are sort of more French, Italian, that kind of region in origin, and they sort of shifted it rest a bit.
Yeah.
And then when it came to the actual standalone movies, they shifted it even further rest and basically turned it into a spaghetti western.
Okay.
Bit of Indiana Jones mixed in for good measure. So in the most recent film, the Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, one of the main antagonists is a wolf named, well, its name is never technically given, it's Wolf. But it's basically the big bad wolf stereotype. Puss knows he's following him around. He thinks he's a bounty hunter trying to, you know, claim him and get the reward.
I wanted to be Winston Wolf, but that's just bringing other film franchises into it. Sorry.
Other wolves are available.
Yeah.
Eventually, this wolf following Puss in Boots around is revealed to be a personification of death. See? Wolf, death.
Okay.
This is where we're going here. It's apparently so incensed by Puss's lack of respect for the entire concept of death. You know, he's got his 9 lives, he's squandered the first 8. And this was considered to be laughing in the face of death.
Okay.
So Wolf finally decides that he's going to take Puss's 9th and final life as some kind of punishment and retribution for this sort of lackadaisy approach to just life in general.
Okay.
But I found myself wondering what sort of informed the character design of this, because so many other characters in the franchise are based on fairy tale. You know, there was a big bad wolf in the original Shrek that's based on the big bad wolf in Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah.
That's dressed as grandmother and all that jazz.
When you mentioned fairy tales being French-Italian in origin, there was a name I was trying to fish out from the back of my mind, and it's just coming to me.
Charles Perrault.
Charles Perrault. He wrote quite a lot of the early fairy tales, didn't he? And he was French, I think. I don't know which ones he did.
Yeah, because I didn't look at Puss in Boots, actually. It might have been one of his, for all we know.
Well, by the time you're listening to this, listener, there's a link in the blog to let you know.
Exactly. It doesn't look like the wolf as death is a fairy tale thing, but it's got some sort of folklorish connotations. Like, a wolf always, pretty much always, spells danger in a fairy tale or a folk tale. Like,
The Boy Who Cried Wolf.
The Boy Who Cried Wolf. And I suppose that is a bit of death at the end as well. But
yeah.
For the innocent lambs, because lambs are always innocent, just like a fox is always cunning, etc., etc. These are just sort of shorthands for different types of people and different characteristics that might be portrayed positively or negatively, depending on the storyteller.
Yeah, and if you're an ancient rural type, a wolf would very much be a real threat to you and your livelihood.
Exactly, which is weird, because before farming, it was basically the other way round. Like, this is how we got to have dogs in the first place. You've got hunting going on that can happen when humans are doing it, alongside the hunting of wolves.
Hmm.
And this is when the dogs partially domesticate themselves and the humans partially domesticate the dogs.
It's sort of a collaborative process. Symbiotic, almost.
Exactly, yeah. I've seen some people sort of postulate that actually we consider the wolf almost a sign of what we left behind. This is
the
wilderness from before we were humans.
Okay.
This is part of the transition process from being this animal species that hunted alongside other animals. And then through these processes, we became what we refer to as human, something distinct.
Just as an aside, while this discussion's been going on, I've just checked Charles Perrault. Yes, French. Yes, Puss in Boots is one of his, along with Little Red Riding Hood, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, and Bluebeard.
I don't know if that's a fairy tale.
Well, no. It's in the list, apparently.
This is a completely different aside of, you know, the original sort of character design of Wolf in Puss in Boots. He dual-wields sickles like a cowboy would revolvers. Like, he spins them and sheaves them and anything you could do with a revolver. And one of the things he does is he crosses his chest whilst holding them.
Right.
Right.
That is a reference to another canid species who is portraying death.
Ooh. Jackal. Are we talking Anubis and things like that?
We're talking Anubis, yes. That is a reference, sort of, to Anubis, who would... You see depictions where he's got his arms crossed with an ankh in one hand to symbolise life, and I kind of pronounce this very carefully. I think it's Kepesh or Kopesh. Unclear which. It's a sickle-shaped sword, basically.
Okay.
They've basically taken a battle axe, and the handle is still quite straight, but the end has got that curved sickle-like point.
All right, okay.
And we have a Grim Reaper that has a scythe. And we have that idea that, you know, you cut down the harvest, you take it in, you reaping the Grim Reaper. Mm. And that is sort of disconnecting the soul from the body and moving it on to the afterlife. And there's this sort of resonance there, like with sickles basically doing the same thing.
Mm. Yeah, I wonder when the our traditional image of the Grim Reaper as a hooded figure with a scythe first appeared, because it's going to be later than Egyptian, no doubt.
Yeah, and
maybe it evolved from Anubis.
One of the slight problems is that the depictions of Anubis with this Kopesh aren't necessarily contemporary. They might be retroactively depicting him with this,
right,
because of a later connotation. Like, the staff that he's got when you see him on temple walls and stuff, we've got depictions of him with a staff that looks a bit more like a shepherd's crook.
Okay.
And that, when Osiris wields a shepherd's crook, that's a symbol of, you know, pharaonic power. That is the I lead, you follow kind of deal.
Right.
And there's that idea again that, well, he's not the one, Anubis is not the one that actually takes you into the afterlife. That's part of the judgment thing, if memory serves. But he's got something not dissimilar, I think, as a representation of the journey. But you don't, when you see that crossed arms thing, I found it very hard to actually find a contemporary depiction that looked like that.
Are you saying there aren't any carved hieroglyph ones with the cross-armed pose?
Not really. You kind of can get some of it, but not all of it at the same time. Mm. If that makes sense? Because you've got to think that this is you had Anubis around for several thousand years. You're going to have different depictions and different connotations at various different times. And we've also got other little bits of Mexican culture as it currently stands that were originally from the indigenous people there. And then that's been sort of reformed into something new. And it's these things that might have influenced the character design. There's El Silbón, the whistler. You know, if you hear this whistle, then the figure of death will get you. And sure
sounds
enough,
sounds like the Banshee's cry.
Well, yes, it does a bit.
Sounds also like M.R. James' ghost stories, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And Death has his little whistle that he taunts Puss with, so that's probably a bit of that. There's a cadeo, which, again, not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, which is basically the equivalent of having the angel and the devil on your shoulders. You got your right one and your black one. Your right one's sort of trying to, you know, have the good things, the black one, the bad things. And again, we're not sure how much of that is influenced by the angel and the devil.
Yeah.
So it's all this big boiling pot that, unfortunately, a lot of things have been burnt in.
Yeah, very good.
So, steer clear of death, folks?
Ideally, yes.
On that note, let's have the explanation, Dave, to your favourite clue.
Yeah, well, if you can remember, it was light fitting in reach, stupidly broken by Trotter, and it was 10 letters. I should have mentioned that Trotter in this instance has a capital T, which gives a bit of a hint for the sitcom Only Fools and Horses, which this clue is referring to. In terms of structure, it was a partial anagram with a container. So the definition part was light fitting, and stupidly can be an anagram indicator. So in reach stupidly means to anagram the letters of in reach. And then broken by Trotter means you need something defined by Trotter to break open or split apart the result of that anagram. And since in reach totals 7 letters, the Trotter needs to be 3 to make up the answers 10. And this is where that knowledge of Only Fools and Horses comes in, because we're going to immediately think of Del Boy Trotter. And if you correctly anagram in reach and you put Del inside it, you get a chandelier, which is a light fitting. And what makes it the clue of the day is that this is one of those instances where the surface reading is entirely truthful and honest, unusually, because quite a famous set piece gag from that show does involve exactly that, the true Trotters stupidly breaking a chandelier. I'm sure we'll have a link to a clip of that from YouTube or something that we can stick in the show notes.
Now that we've given you the punchline.
No, basically, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Well,
spoiler alert.
Enjoy how it's played out. Anyway, General, what was your choice of clue?
I'm not immune to potty humour, so my favourite clue was 16 across, which quite simply read, wee-wee in dribbles. That's a three-word answer of lengths 6, 2 and 6.
Marvellous. Okay, well, we'll get the answer for that from you after we learn what Void found in the grid to jump off from. What have you got to tell us about?
Well, when I was solving this puzzle, it looked like there was going to be a Nina, a hidden message, down the sides of the grid. We've talked about why they're called Ninas before, and there's a link in the blog if you want to recap. But no, there was the word ball on the left-hand side, but the rest of the two sides was just gobbledygook. And Philbert the Setter is not particularly known as a serial Ninaist, I don't think. But I looked around the rest of the puzzle anyway. And in column 11, I found Ariate. Now, does that mean anything to you?
No.
To me, no.
I'm not surprised because it's complete nonsense until you reverse it and then you get Hetaira.
Oh, that's...
Does that ring a bell?
A vague one, yeah. I suspect this is more of your kind of Hellenic history kind of stuff. It's got a,
it is an ancient Greek word.
Greek feeling to it, yeah.
I don't think Philbert put it in there deliberately. It's just one of the accidents and coincidences that happen from time to time in grid building. Its meaning is, I'm going to say, female companion.
All right.
With certain degrees of variance. I'm not going to go into that topic now, but I am going to recommend to you something I mentioned before, the show Natalie Haynes Stands Up for the Classics, in particular, in this case, the episodes on Phryne and Aspasia. Links in the blog, folks. You do read the blog, right? Yeah? Good. Good. We do a lot of link mining for you. It's, you know,
there's a lot of good stuff in there.
Yeah. Anyway, so what am I going to talk about? I thought I would look at hidden or accidental words and messages. And staying in the ancient world, Herodotus has a story to tell us, because he usually does. Histiaeus was the tyrant of Miletus, which is where? In modern-day Turkey, that's right. And tyrant, we can just take as meaning ruler, more or less. But he was under the auspices, under the rule of King Darius of Persia. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this is very late 6th, early 5th century BCE. He, Histiaeus, found himself transferred to Susa, S-U-S-A, to serve as advisor to Darius, but he wasn't particularly happy about it, and he wanted to go back to Miletus. So, naturally, what he did was he got his most trusted servant and he shaved his head. And then he tattooed a message on his scalp. And then he waited for the servant's hair to grow back. And then he sent the servant off back to Miletus, where Histiaeus' nephew was in charge, with instructions to shave the servant's hair off again to reveal the message. Which he did, and this revealed a message that he was to start a revolt against the Persians, which he did, and they attacked the city of Sardis, and Histiaeus got himself sent off by Darius to put down the revolt, which he'd actually instigated in the first place. So a successful bit of sneaky messaging for him. Although, ultimately, it didn't work out very well for him, as these stories tend not to. I was thinking about the logistics of this situation.
You've got to make sure enough time passes, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, how long is someone's hair going to take to grow back enough to obscure a tattoo on their head? I mean, a month if it's fast growing? A bit more?
I suppose it depends on your mode of transport to get there, I guess.
No, I think it needs to be hidden at the point at which you're setting off, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yes. So that,
because otherwise you might just bump into someone.
You'd be rumbled, yeah.
You just spend most of the journey wearing a hat for some reason, you know. Oh, isn't it sunny out?
I could just wear a hat, boss. No, don't shave your head.
But this is steganography you're talking about.
That one is, yes.
Mm, yeah.
It's just hiding or coding messages up, yeah. Other hidden messages, the next last thing I've got is on songs.
Oh, God, yes.
In the 1980s, there were lots of conspiracy theorists or troublemakers, he started to agitate that various artists were hiding satanic reversed messages in the records.
The music go back, you hear Satan speaking.
Exactly. I mean, the accusers were generally fundamentalist Christians, so yeah, read into that what you will. The thing is, though, plenty of bands had used this technique called backmasking, notably the Beatles, and therefore also the Ruttles. But generally, these were just sort of silly messages or in-jokes among the band members, and nothing satanic at all.
Don't play it this way, play it the other way, you fool.
Yeah. But after these accusations started becoming more widespread, the result was that more and more artists started actually doing it as a piss take of the accusations. So Motorhead, Ozzy Osbourne, Iron Maiden, the B-52s, and Half Man, Half Biscuit all had a go. There'll be a lot more, which we'll link to in the blog. But the acme of the ridiculousness of it all was that Judas Priest, the metal band, got taken to court.
Yes.
Because allegedly they had encouraged the suicide of a couple of teens because they had a so-called backmasked message of "do it" in one of their songs. It seems to me a bit tenuous. And
I mean, it's two syllables and he can do anything, couldn't it, really?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
It's,
I mean,
it's like what? The "let him have it", isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
What was that? Derek Bentley.
Yeah, that was a case in the 50s or early 60s where someone was convicted for having said "let him have it" to his accomplice who shot somebody, and the defence were arguing that he was saying "surrender your weapon to him", whereas the prosecution were arguing that he was saying "shoot him".
Was this the court case where they basically had to try and explain that no, you can't put a secret message onto the record without someone at the record knowing? And like, they had to actually explain the technical process of backmasking and say that no, we're not trying to put satanic messages in. If you were doing this, this is an actual physical thing that you were doing. There's something to that effect.
Possibly. I didn't look up the full details of the court case. The two teens who killed themselves, which I have to say I'm sorry that happened, obviously, but apparently before they'd done this, they'd taken alcohol and marijuana. So it seems to me that could possibly
not a great
be
combination.
A much larger factor.
Yeah.
The case was dismissed.
Yeah.
I'm very glad to say. And Judas Priest carried on to make more records. Bill Hicks, the American comedian, had a skit on it all where he said, "Dude, if you're playing records backwards, you are Satan." But anyway, CDs came along and you can't play them backwards.
Yeah, no, I'm sitting next to a turntable which does have a reverse button on it, so it's, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
You are Satan.
Thank you. You say the nicest things.
Vinyl's back now, so...
time for a renaissance.
Just like to say... 1, 2, 3, 4 Yes, I will. Cool. Right, General, give us the explanation, please, to your chosen clue.
Oh, gosh, yes. Right, so that read "Riri in dribbles". And "in dribbles" here is the definition. "Riri alone" is the wordplay. But we're not talking about urine at all. We want "ri" instead as small, like a "ri dram" or whatever. And thus, when you say "riri", what you're really doing is you've got two instances of a word that means tiny next to each other. You might describe that, therefore, as little by little, which is the answer. If something happens in dribbles, it occurs little by little. So that's it's very tidy because there's nothing extraneous. And it basically means I got to say the word "re" a lot.
You can say it again if you like.
Whee!
Yes. Yes. Neat, and as you say, it does all the things that a clue is supposed to do and nothing else, and is kind of silly and childish while it's at it.
I like that. I like that very much.
Meanwhile, my choice of clue from Philbert was 24 down, "wrap up warmly", which is three letters. Another very short clue and succinct, which I will explain after Dave tells us a story.
Right. Well, I think in a previous episode, I picked up on the word tilde in the grid. And this time I spotted another diacritic, which is Macron at 6 across. Now, Philbert clued it with reference to the French president of that name, and I'm sure there are interesting things to research about him, but I'm going to leap instead straight from one of my usual topics, the visual presentation of language in print and so on. So I thought I'd have a quick run through some of the most common accents and diacritics. Isn't that fun, folks?
Yes, honestly.
We'll tell you in 10 minutes.
We'll tell you in 10 minutes, yeah. So do you know which one the Macron is and what it's used for?
It's the line on top of a letter.
A horizontal line, yeah.
Horizontal line, yes.
We've got, you know, acutes and graves, which are upward and downward sloping lines and things, but this is a straight line, yeah.
So is that, therefore, used to indicate that it's a long vowel sound?
It certainly is. And in fact, you know, you've talked about the ancient Greek and things a lot in your blurbs, and it just is the ancient Greek word for long.
Oh, okay.
Oh, macro, yes, big.
Yeah. So some examples, perhaps, are in the Maori language. The word Maori itself has got a macron on the A, so for a long A. I've got some CDs and records by a Japanese composer called Michiru Oshima, who has a macron on the O, and so on. So the next obvious question is there a diacritic mark to mark specifically a short vowel?
I mean, obviously.
That would be called...
The dot?
It's the brev, which is this time from the Latin brevis, for short. Same source brevity. As our words, brief and brevity and so on. It's a sort of bowl shape, like the bottom half of a circle.
Oh, okay, that one.
Mm, yeah. And we have, of course, far more familiar perhaps, is the circumflex, often just called a hat. This is the sort of upward-pointing chevron shape. Again, this one comes from the Latin... Circumflexus, bent around. It's got various uses in different languages for changing the tone of vowels. That's also often an indicator for a long vowel. But in French, which I think where you're probably most familiar with seeing a circumflex, this goes on a long vowel that's compensating for the loss of a deleted consonant, most commonly an S. So if you imagine in Old French, there are a bunch of words that were spelled with an S in them, where the pronunciation changed over time and the S was lost. But they wanted to sort of commemorate that absence in the orthography. So they stick a circumflex over the vowel before where the S would have been.
Okay, so does that mean that chateau used to be more like the word castle?
It's... Very, very likely does, yeah. So it's a case of where as soon as you see that, you can see it at work where other languages, like you just said, have got much the same word and have kept the S. You've gone for chateau and castle. You think of English isle as I-S-L-E. So we've also lost the S from the pronunciation, but we've kept it in the spelling. Mm. And the French have got île, I, circumflex, L-E.
Oh, yeah. Mm. I'm going to be saying, oh, yeah, a lot. From yeah,
exactly. I've got l'hôpital, hospital.
Oh, yeah.
And how about the German Fenster, French Fenêtre? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we went window.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm a Mac user.
So that's sort of interesting things with the circumflex. If you turn that upside down, so a downward-pointing chevron, and that is the Hachek or Charon. It's got two names. And the naming for this one is a bit bizarre. As far as linguists are concerned, it's a Hachek. It's one that's used in languages like Czech. In this case, the name comes from the Czech for small hook.
Okay.
And the name itself, the word Hachek, uses one. It's a nice sort of recursiveness.
Yep.
So it's H-A-C, Hachek, E-K. But font designers and typographers tend to know it as a Charon because that's the name it's got in the Unicode specification and nobody knows why.
That spelt? Is it spelt the same as the ferryman over the Styx?
No, without the H. More like the actress Leslie Caron.
Okay, yeah.
So C-A-R-O-N.
Did someone just make a mistake?
That's the assumption. Yes, that's what I've got, is that it's presumed to have been a mistake. Yeah. Chambers says, another name for the Hatchek, Origin Obscure. The OED, shockingly, doesn't list it at all.
What's a caret, C-A-R-E-T? Isn't that another word for the circumflex?
Well, the kind of much larger one that you have on keyboards above, perhaps the letter, the number above the number six, I think sometimes gets referred to as a caret. It's originally, that is the term for the insertion mark. If you're proofreading and you put a little sort of chevron at the baseline to say where you're going to insert another letter or word, that's what the caret was originally. So I think the kind of larger circumflex has kind of taken on that name in kind of computing terms, perhaps.
Okay, so no connection between caret and caron. Probably.
There are some theories that the caron as a name might be a kind of accidental smooshing together of the caret and the macron, oddly enough. See. Who knows? There's not any kind of definable history to it. It's strange. But the one that I was going to talk about is one that, again, goes by two, three, maybe four different names, but at least this time for decent reasons. What is the name, guys, for two little dots side by side on top of a letter?
Well, it depends on your language, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The one I know is umlaut.
Likewise.
I do know it has another name as well, but I can't remember what
it is. It's got a couple of different names.
Okay.
I was going to say diuresis.
Well, here we go.
Pills for that.
Here we go. Hey! Just as a character, irrespective of which usage it is, for which language and which purpose, it's called a trema. And that name comes from an ancient Greek word for hole. And that word is also used for the dots on a dice, or on a die.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, for the use where it indicates that a letter is to be pronounced as a separate syllable from the ones that go before it, so often on a second of a pair of vowels, like in a word like naive, or in names like Zoe and Chloe, in that context. And I've always said what you just said, General, diuresis. Mm-hmm. And it does sound like a medical condition.
Mm-hmm.
And I realised that I'd only ever seen it written down and not heard it spelt out loud, spoken out loud. So I went and checked, and apparently it's diuresis. So we are both educated on that.
Well, I never know how to pronounce most things anyway.
No, well, they are.
What is this diacritic called when it's used by heavy metal bands purely for effect?
I'm coming to that.
Oh!
But before that, one last bit, that was brought to my attention, one famous literary use of the diuresis is, of course, on the surname Bronte. But apparently that was something of a stylistic affectation also, so kind of precursor to the heavy metal, perhaps. The sisters, Anne, Charlotte, Emily, obviously inherited the surname from their father, Patrick. He was an Irish Anglican minister, and his name was originally spelt Brunty, B-R-U-N-T-Y. He decided, also for reasons unknown, to respell it as B-R-O-N-T-E, diuresis, after moving to England, having gained a theology scholarship at St. John's College, Cambridge.
It looked posher.
It looked posher. This is the thing, yeah. Yes, so the umlaut, which is the one that you mentioned, obviously, this is the name for the same character when it's modifying the sound of a single vowel, as in German, schon to schön. Umlaut literally means changed sound. Yeah, and then when it's used to no linguistic effect whatsoever, but merely for graphical style reasons, it is called a metal umlaut.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, so what do you got? You've got Motorhead on the second O. You've got
I think you find that's Motorhead.
Motorhead, yes. Well, in that case, Mötley Crüe.
Yeah.
Try it, Queensryche. And how does it affect the pronunciation of the N in Spinal Tap?
Pass.
Yeah. Okay, so what was your answer, Void, and why?
Okay, the clue was wrap up warmly, ? And often, very often, when a clue is just two or three words long, you think it's a double definition. So I thought, right, it's going to be a word that means both wrap up and warmly in two different ways. I didn't figure the answer out until I had the first letter H and the last letter G, and then I realised that the answer was actually hug. So it's just a cryptic definition, the wrapping up being done with your arms around another person and the warmth being emotional rather than temperature. So yeah, it's just a sweet little cute cryptic definition, hug, wrap up warmly.
Yeah, nice and brief for a short word.
Yeah. Well, it's time for the general knowledge quiz.
Three.
Question one. From 18 down, Yiddish. What's the difference between a schlemiel and a schlemozzle? Bonus Ooh. Points if you can also distinguish them from a schmendrick.
A schnozzle is your nose.
No, but he said a schmozzle.
Yeah.
We're looking for a schlemozzle.
Schlemozzle, oh dear.
The version that appears in Chambers is S-C-H-L-I-M-A-Z-E-L. There are a lot of other spellings depending on how you convert it into, you know, the Roman alphabet.
Mm.
Right. Well, I think a schmozzle, as I would probably pronounce it, is just a messed up, disastrous situation.
Kind of.
Okay.
Whereas a schlemiel is definitely a person rather than a situation. It's a useless or kind of...
Yeah.
Sort of, it's sort of like a milksop, isn't it, I think?
That's kind of more like a schmendrick.
Okay.
There's an old Yiddish joke / witticism. It was already described as old in 1942. The joke goes that a schlemiel is the guy who spills his soup, and a schlemozzle is the guy he spills it on.
Okay.
The schlemiel is the clumsy person, the bungler, and the schlemozzle is the persistently unlucky person.
The unlucky person, okay.
Yeah. And Void is right to say that it is kind of a mess. It's kind of a situation because we're getting schlemozzle from schlimm, German for bad, and the mozzle bit, as in mazel tov, is luck.
Luck, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So a bit of bad luck, but also then applying to a person with bad luck.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the schmendrick is... I had an article gloriously titled Etiquette for Schmucks, Schlemiels, Schlemozzles and Schmendricks. A lovely little thing that described the schmendrick as a pathetic sad sack.
A sad sack, okay, right.
Basically, it comes from the character in Schmendrick oder die komische Cartoone, play Schmendrick or the comical Reading by Abraham Goldfarben in 1877.
So a character's name at that point.
Yeah, it's not clear if Goldfarben actually made the name up, but there's because you can kind of see that there's a bit of a schmuck in the Schmendrick and a bit of dreck in the Schmendrick too, but it's kind of what it means is pretty clear. And a schmuck is in the same sort of category, because, you know, we had the etiquette for schmucks, schlemiels, etc. It's a little bit hard to define, apparently. Not necessarily someone who's a jerk, but they do behave jerkishly. Not necessarily because they are malicious, but because they don't know any better.
Don't be a schmuck.
Basically, yes.
The phrase, yeah, don't behave like that.
Yeah. It's just a word that means penis.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to take notes and be more careful about how I'm using these words in future if I ever do.
A slub, a talentless, unattractive, or boorish person. There we are.
See, they got plenty of words for some kind of loser, basically.
Yeah,
They got a classification system.
All right, what's next?
Question two comes from 9 across, blue. Which of these colours isn't a kind of blue? Celeste? Fulvus, livid, smalt, and zaffer.
Okay, livid means blue.
Bonus points if you can tell me which two are related.
Give us them again.
Celeste.
Well, that sounds to me like to do with the sky, so it's probably a sky blue.
It's from the heraldic tincture, blue celeste. French sky blue.
What's the next one?
Fulvous. F-U-L-V-O-U-S.
That would be yellow.
Reddish brown.
Okay, the Liber Paginarum Fulvarum from Terry Pratchett again.
Mm-hmm.
It's the yellow pages.
It shows up a lot in sort of Latin species names, and also just in the English version of species names. There's a Fulvous Whistling Duck, if you want one.
Not right now.
No, I'm giving them up.
But you see Fulva a lot in sort of the binomial names for things.
Mm-hmm. Do other ducks think that one is a herald of their death?
I don't know.
It's whistling at them.
It does whistle. The trouble is...
You're just trying to link all the bits, weave the strands together.
It's all connected. What were the other two words?
Yeah, so that was the opposite one because it was orange. Livid, as you say, black and blue. Lividus, a colour that is like lead.
Okay.
But then it sort of became generic discoloured, like, you know, because if you are bruised, you are discoloured. And then it got more associated with turning pale for some reason. And then it became attached to the idea of someone getting so angry they turned pale, which is why we describe someone as looking livid when they're angry. Mm-hmm. So the two related words were the smalt and zaffa. And zaffa, you might just about be able to spot the Latin sapphirus, or sapphire, as it eventually became.
Oh, okay.
And it was the alchemist's name for the deep blue pigment that they made by roasting cobalt. Well, cobalt ore. And they made a cobalt oxide out of that. And we've sort of got that from alchemists in the 1500s. And then, after that, they realised they could mix it with molten glass and get coloured blue glass out of that.
Right.
And it was very popular with mosaic artists, especially in Italy, where they had this practice of putting, well, originally bits of coloured enamel into their mosaics, but eventually bits of coloured glass too, in a practice called smalto.
Yeah, so smalt would be your other, this is some cobalt-y thing, isn't it?
Because what painting artists realise is they could grind this glass down and make a pigment out of that. And they call that pigment smalt.
S-M-A-L-T?
Indeed.
Right, okay.
And funnily enough, smalt related to schmaltz, Yiddish word, as per earlier, some Proto-Germanic smetlana, not pronounced like that because it's be pronounced in a Proto-Germanic accent, but you can call it in your own imagination. And finally, question three comes from one across, thespian.
Thespian.
I should really have stuck with stage for thespian, but I went to film instead. And specifically, I went to the film Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Mm-hmm.
George Peppard and Audrey Hepburn.
Indeed, indeed. But who was the only actor in Breakfast at Tiffany's to win a Hollywood Award for their performance? Bonus points if you can name any of their other roles.
Hmm.
And it wasn't those two, presumably.
Neither of those two. Audrey Hepburn was nominated, but
did
she
they have
win.
Like a pet dog or something?
She had a cat.
She had a cat.
Was it the cat?
It was the cat.
Hey!
I had to get a cat in somehow.
Marvellous.
It was the Patsy Award.
I leapt in almost the right direction, but not
quite. Almost the right direction. Holly Golightly has a cat that she refuses to name because, you know, she owes nothing to it. It's a free spirit, just like she is.
Yeah, she just calls it Cat, doesn't she?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And Cat
Combo
was...
I had a dog that he called Dog. And that goes back to an episode, earlier episode.
The cat's name was Orangey Minerva. Normally Orangey. It picked up Minerva due to its first sort of big TV role. In which
Bewitched?
We're talking 1960s here. Well, actually, 1952 was the first episode on TV of Our Miss Brooks.
Oh, not heard of it.
No, I haven't heard of it either, but apparently that it was a radio show beforehand that was turned into TV, and when it came to TV, they needed a cat.
Okay, I think that's about time to wrap up. Thanks for listening, folks. Please subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts. Show notes, as always, at offgrid.tlmb.net. And you can, if you want to, come and say hi to us on socials. I'm at Skirwingle everywhere. I also recommend checking out my cartoon strip, peoplewithissues.org.
And speaking of saying hello, it only took 2.5 years, but we've had our first Apple podcast review from outside the UK. Hooray!
So thank you, folks.
Thank you very much to Curious Listener for letting the USA know that we are worth a listen. It really makes a big difference to us, and you can too if you're an academic in Dublin, a programmer in Maryland, a beekeeper in Surrey, or a physicist in Greasefold. Do feel free to leave us a message. We would love it if you left us a review and some star full ratings. Meanwhile, I'm at the void TLNB in several places, mostly Mastodon. General, your recommendations this time around?
Well, you could always look out for Panthera and the crosswords that they set on mycrossword.com. They can be found at Panthera Puzzles on, you know, X or Blue Sky, even on Twitch, where they sometimes do puzzle streams whenever the kind folks at Cryptic Sunday can't manage it.
Excellent stuff.
Those are all marvellous recommendations. Yes. Thank you so much for your expertise again this week, General Knowledge.
As always, it is my pleasure.
We'll see you all next time, folks.
Bye, folks. Bye.
Cheerio.
Off Grid is a TLNB production. Thank you to Filbert and The Independent for the crossword. Our theme tune is by The Trudy, who you can find on Bandcamp, YouTube, or thetrudy.co.uk. Hello to our new, I think, listener in Finland. Have you seen a Rydalin and Kisa? See you next time. Bye.
I'm giving you everything you've
got.